I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. The Baltimore City State's attorney oversees more than 200 lawyers and the prosecution of tens of thousands of criminal cases every year. It's a tough and important job, and in next month's Democratic primary, there are two lawyers competing with the incumbent to have it. Today, we continue our series of conversations with the candidates with one of them. Baltimore attorney and former city prosecutor Ivan Bates joins me. The incumbent state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, has attracted national attention and some heated criticism for her handling of the trials in the Freddie Gray case. What might Mr. Bates have done differently over the last few years? And is that the measure by which voters should decide whether or not he's a better choice to be the city's top prosecutor? Ivan Bates joins me when Midday starts right after the news. Good afternoon and welcome. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad that you're with us today. We continue our series of conversations with the candidates. Here in Baltimore, the city's top prosecutor is the Baltimore City State's Attorney, a position that is often in the eye of the storm surrounding some very high-profile criminal cases. The incumbent state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby, attracted national attention with her decision to indict six officers involved in the arrest of Freddie Gray in 2015. Mr. Gray died while in police custody. None of the indicted officers were convicted of a crime. But while cases like those involving Freddie Gray get a lot of scrutiny, the state's attorney's office prosecuted more than 41,000 cases in 2017. The state's attorney oversees more than 400 people, including more than 200 lawyers, and the salary is the highest of any city employee. It's a big job, and there are two people who are challenging the incumbent for that job in next month's Democratic primary. My guest today is one of those challengers. Ivan Bates is a veteran litigator, defense attorney, and city prosecutor. He earned his BA in journalism at Howard University in 1992. He got a law degree at William & Mary in 1995. He was admitted to the Maryland Bar that year, and after clerking for Judge David B. Mitchell on the Circuit Court of Baltimore City, he served as an assistant state's attorney in Baltimore, where he worked in the Juvenile Crime Division and later the Homicide Division. He started his own law practice in 2006. Ivan Bates is 49 years old. He and his wife, Dr. Lana Bates, live in Rampart Mews in South Baltimore with their daughters, Brielle and London. We are streaming our conversation on the WIPR Facebook page later in the program. We'll take your calls, your emails, and tweets. But for now, Mr. Bates, welcome to the show. It's nice to meet you.
Thank you, Mr. Hall. Thank you very much for having me.
So let's start with a sort of basic premise. What, in your view, is the capacity of the state's attorney to reduce crime in Baltimore?
When you look at the criminal justice system, there are three main parts. The police, they make arrest. That's a short-term solution. The judges, they sentence. That can be a long-term solution. But the state's attorney, which I feel is the most important part, must, one, put together good cases to hold people accountable, and number two, must make sure that they can properly evaluate what's happening within the criminal justice system. So to answer your question simply, state's attorney's office has all the ability to regulate what's happening in reference to the criminal justice system in our city.
That's in reference to the criminal justice system, and I understand that argument. But when it comes to the sort of on-the-street murders, robberies, assaults in your office, I guess the premise of my question is, should, if you're elected, or should Marilyn Mosby be reelected, should anybody in that who holds that position be responsible if the crime goes up, be responsible if the crime goes down? I mean, is there a metric in your mind that directly correlates between the person in that job and the number of people being killed and assaulted in our city?
Without a doubt. When you sit down and look at crime from 2009 until now, just the murders, every year we were in the 200 mark. The past 3 years, once the incumbent became in office, we jumped to 300. Why? 100-plus prosecutors have left out of 200. More than half the office has left. You've now lost 800 years of experience. How does that relate? If you do not hold the violent repeat offenders accountable and send them to prison, then they will come right back out on the streets and they will inflict the crime. What we see now is a revolving door in a way we've never seen it before. You only need to look at the trials that the state's attorney's office has done. And that, to me, is the number one thing to judge the state's attorney's office by, trials. A trial can, when you go to trial, the state's attorney is saying that we have the evidence to prove this person guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. So in 2016, those are the latest numbers we have. You have the state's attorney's office winning 175 trials, but losing 237 trials. So being a defense attorney, what I've learned is this. Over there in the jail, central booking, they sit on tiers, individuals charged with the crimes, and they sit and they listen, they read, they talk about their cases. And the violent offenders are sitting there without bail. They're sitting there going to trial, then they come home. When I say they come home, they go home because they're winning their cases, they're going back on the streets. And that's showing everybody in there in the jail that you're not going to be held accountable and you can go home. So we found out every 10 violent offenders that go to trial, 6 of them are going home. You have to change that. When you sit down and look at the administrations of Ethan Bernstein and Ms. Jessamy,
the state's attorney who preceded Marilyn Mosby.
You can sit down and see they were winning at least 70% of their trials easily. So there's a big difference right there.
How do you then account for Ms. Mosby's assertion that in her office, the Felony Trial and Special Victims Unit closed the year with 92% and 94% conviction rates, respectively?
I mean, that's just simply not true. I'm in the trenches. They're not winning cases. Do we feel safer now than we did 3 years ago? The answer is no. And I know I saw the other news media, I think Fox News, WBFF News has done something. The Baltimore Sun has done something. The Wall Street Journal has done something. No one comes up with 92%. What Ms. Mosby's doing is she's only counting guilty pleas. And I keep in mind, what they're doing to extract guilty pleas out of repeat violent offenders is charging them with a felony, lowering it to a misdemeanor, and pleading someone to time served. And then they're saying that, oh, we have a 92% conviction rate. But they do not count all the null process or the stets. And when you have to count the null process and the stets, when
you look at the null process are these cases that are dismissed.
So basically, I think they did a show that almost 40% out of all the cases the state's attorney's office has, they're dismissing. So when you actually count those, and out of all the cases that they handle, they're only convicting maybe 50% of the people, and that's including pleas. And so once you look at that number is terrible. So you have to have prosecutors who, one, can hold people accountable, but also prosecutors who know a good case from a bad case and can tell the police, this case isn't ripe to go to trial. We need more evidence. Once you do that, you're able to hold individuals accountable. Once you're able to hold individuals accountable, they're not out here in the street committing more crime.
Well, not to belabor a point, but let me ask you why it is that the trials and the number of trials you win is, in your estimation, the best metric to judge somebody's performance. Why isn't it the number of crimes that are committed in general, whether they're prosecuted or not, or the number of arrests? I mean, for example, this year, the number of arrests are down. They've been down for the last couple of years. The number of crimes is up, but the number of people being arrested is actually down. What about the clearance rate? You know, the Baltimore City Police said in 2017, they cleared 50% of their cases, roughly. In Baltimore County, it's 74% of their cases. And that 50% number is actually ticked up a little bit from the prior year. Why aren't those metrics as important, or are they even more important than the number of cases that the state's attorney's office brings to trial and wins?
An arrest is a short-term solution. When you sit down, being a criminal defense attorney in the past, when you sit down and you talk, the criminal element's not afraid of being arrested. It's part of what happens in the culture. They are afraid of being held accountable. So when you sit down and look at a trial, the state's attorney's office is saying, one, we believe in this case. Number two, we believe this person is guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. And number three, that's how you can sit down and see is the state's attorney's office doing their job. They're taking cases before the citizens. And the citizens of Baltimore City are saying not guilty over and over and over again. There's no plea bargains. It's just the citizens deciding that this is not enough evidence to provide, say, this person's guilty beyond a reasonable doubt. Once you're saying guilty and the juries are saying guilty, the judges will sentence appropriately. Remember, the judges live in the city as well.
This job is in many ways an administrative job as much as it is a prosecutorial job. I mean, you oversee a big office, 400 plus people, roughly half of them, as I understand it, are attorneys. The way that Ms. Mosby has decided to organize her office differed in some large measure from the way Mr. Bernstein, her predecessor, organized the office. How do you see the office itself, how do you see the way the thing runs being different? Would it be different were you to be elected?
Without a doubt. The first thing I do, I step in day one with 23 years experience. Remember, Ms. Mosby was an insurance attorney and has never, ever in her career tried a murder case. So,
but she had been with the state's attorney's office prior to working for the insurance company.
She had, but she was doing a lot of misdemeanor cases, was in felony for a brief period. We actually had a couple of matters together, very brief period. It takes a long time to work your way through the ranks to figure out what's happening within the court system. It's just something that you don't get every day. I remember when I was hired, they said it takes a minimum of 5 years to figure out what you're doing, at least 10 years to figure out if you can be good, and then another 10 years to figure out can you manage it and become great. And so when you sit down and look at it, it's the experience. We sit down and look at the experience in terms of administration that's around Ms. Mosby. None of them had ever prosecuted a murder case until the Freddie Gray matter. So the amount of
So there you're talking about, for example, a man named Michael
Schatzel
and
Janice Bledsoe. And then you can look at a young lady.
But those are very highly, those two in particular, very highly respected attorneys.
They were highly respected as a civil attorney and highly respected as a defense attorney. Now, I look at it like this. If you need open heart surgery, are you going to a surgeon who performs surgery on your brain, your head, your leg, your arm? See, being a prosecutor, it takes a certain skill. I was able to be in district court, deal with misdemeanors, juvenile court, focus on juveniles, felony, understand what's going on in the felony division, but homicide. The 2 years I spent on homicide were a whole learning experience on another level. I almost spent an entire year just learning at the knee of so many of the other great attorneys who were in that office before they actually put me in the courtroom. Because when you're asking for a person to be held guilty for responsible for a murder, the amount of work, the amount of attention to detail that is in place is at a whole nother level. And so the thing is, when you've had almost 100 plus, well, not almost, I think it's 103 or 104 lawyers leave, you've lost 800 years experience. So who's training the younger prosecutors? I'm the only person in this race that at least 30 people out of the 100 plus have left, say they want to come back and work with me. I'm the only one former prosecutors that have left want to come back and work with. Now, many of them left on their own accord because they just didn't like what was going on in the office, but they went to governmental agencies. They want to come back and finish the job they were doing. And you can sit down and see under the Greg Bernstein administration, and even some under the Pat Dresser administration, they were prosecutors who knew the job of being a prosecutor, their heart was in it, and they were doing it for the right reasons, and they were successful.
So to clarify for listeners, when you were in the state's attorney's office, Patricia Jessamy was the state's attorney, right?
Yes, she was.
Yeah. So this was two state's attorneys ago.
Yes, I was in the state's attorney's office from 1996 till 2002.
You talked about the Noel Prost cases and the Stett cases. Stetts are one that are sort of taken off the dockets. Let's talk about these Noel Prost cases, so-called. In other words, cases that are dropped.
Yes, sir.
So the prosecuting state's attorney's office brings charges against somebody, indicts somebody, gets a grand jury maybe to say, yeah, this person is likely to have, or there's enough evidence to bring it to trial.
Yes, sir.
And then for whatever reason, before it gets to trial, and sometimes these folks who are indicted spend a good bit of time in jail waiting to be tried, for whatever reason, and it's obviously different in every case, the case is ultimately dropped, they're released from jail, and that's that. So how do you reduce the number of cases that are dropped?
Well, one of the things that I know Mrs. Jessamy did that was always important and I looked at, when a person's arrested, all cases originate in a district court. And they have 30 days to eventually get it to the circuit court. So what happens is a person's arrested and they'll eventually have what's called a preliminary hearing. What's happened often under Ms. Mosby's administration is they indict all the cases. Well, I believe we should go back to a system of having preliminary hearings because that allows us to flush out whether it's a good case or a bad case. Are we able to contact and connect with the witnesses? And is there enough evidence to proceed within that 30-day time period? Once you do that, you have an opportunity to really look at the case in another level. It also allows the police to sit down and testify, because you can sit down and see, you know, is this a good case or is it not a good case? Because just what the officer may write in a report may be a little different than the way they may or may not testify. Also remember, we have a lot of young officers here on the police force. Many of them don't even testify until they're called as a witness, potentially in a homicide or a home invasion. Preliminary hearings allow officers to feel comfortable testifying and also allows younger prosecutors the opportunity to have a better skill set in understanding how to handle cases in the courtroom. It allows everybody to have a better additional level of judgment and understanding a good case from a bad case. And when you see there's a bad case, we need to dismiss it immediately, because we can't have people sitting in jail waiting 6, 8 months, 9 months before we realize that it's not a good case.
All right. When we come back from a quick break, we will talk more about that relationship between the state's attorney's office and the police here in Baltimore, as well as the relationship between the police and the community. Ivan Bates is a trial attorney in private practice at the moment here in Baltimore. He's also a former city prosecutor. He's one of three candidates running in the Democratic primary for Baltimore State's attorney. We'll have more with Ivan Bates after a quick break. When we come back, we will take your questions, your comments. Our phone number here at Midday, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. And we are, again, streaming on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Quick look ahead to tomorrow's show. Derek Thompson is a senior editor at The Atlantic magazine. He's written a really interesting book about why certain things and certain people and songs and movies become popular. His book is a bestseller. It's called Hitmakers: The Science of Popularity in the Age of Distraction. It is a fascinating foray into the forces that shape today's cultural phenomena. So I hope you'll join us for that coming up on Midday tomorrow. If you've just joined us today, we're continuing our series of conversations with the candidates. Ivan Bates is my guest. He's an attorney and former city prosecutor and one of three candidates vying for the Democratic nomination for Baltimore City State's Attorney in the primary next month. He's hoping to unseat the incumbent state's attorney, Marilyn Mosby. The other candidate in the race is Thiru Vignaraja. Whoever wins the primary will run unopposed in the November election. You are welcome to join our conversation with questions and comments for Mr. Bates, 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org, to send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR. If you want to send me a tweet, I won't be able to read it during the show, but I'd be delighted to have you follow me on Twitter at @TomHallWYPR. We are streaming on the WYPR Facebook page, so you can get in touch with us that way as well. Mr. Bates, we have a email from Dick in Baltimore City. He says, the bail bond industry preys on the poor. Pre-trial services are working in St. Mary's County and elsewhere. More recently, as per a one-year program evaluation period, now underway. So you took $10,000 from the bail bond industry. Please talk about that.
Well, one of the things—
I assume he's talking about a campaign contribution.
Yes. It's interesting because when you look at the pre-trial system here in Baltimore City, there is none. What we've seen since they've gotten rid of bail, mass incarceration has happened at a record pace. When you sit down and look at the bail bond industry, they proposed a bill because the General Assembly will not fund adequately pretrial services. In Baltimore City, you're only entitled to one and only one bail review. So as a defense attorney, my clients would have a alibi, and I couldn't give it to the state's attorney's office, and the judge would not give me another bail hearing. I supported a bill by Representative Muse that allowed for a second bail hearing because we found that too many people were being held the wrong way. Now, they never ruled on that bill, and consequently, we've watched mass incarceration happen to the very people that so many people want to help. Unfortunately, I had a client, he had a prior felony drug conviction from the 90s. He picked up another drug charge. Do you know the judge held him without bail because the state's attorney's office asked? And it wasn't that many pieces of drugs. So when we sit down and look, we don't have any other system other than to let people go on their own recognizance or to hold people. In Baltimore City, so many people have prior arrest, prior convictions, which meant that if you don't have the opportunity to be released, then everybody was going to be incarcerated. So I've watched incarceration explode. So it wasn't as much that I support the bail bonds industry, but I was jumping up and down and screaming, asking the General Assembly to do something. There are no real pretrial services. Do you realize some of the same people that asked for electronic monitoring, there's no electronic monitoring in Baltimore City. Now, in Baltimore County it is, St. Mary's it is. So I think it's important to understand we have a system with no hope in sight. And the only way we could try to provide some sort of hope was to say, let's at least give an individual a second bail review. Because right now, individuals get one and only one bail review in the district court level. Outside of that, they're sitting in jail for 9 months before, as we stated earlier, the state's attorney's office decides to dismiss the case. So then they lose everything.
Of course, the conversation about whether or not there should even be cash bail is a whole other conversation, and we'll have that some other time. I want to talk about something that has evidently gravely impacted the criminal justice system here in Baltimore, and that's the GTTF trial. Yes. This is the Gun Trace Task Force. Eight officers convicted of terrible, nefarious criminal activity, which has greatly continued to exacerbate the distrust that the community has for the constitutional behavior of the police department. You have been involved in the GTTF case in terms of some of the victims who have been affected by some of the officers in that case. Talk about what the nature of that involvement has been and whether or not, given the nature of that involvement, you're essentially in a position, as I understand it, of suing the police department. If you're elected state's attorney, how do you then have a good working relationship with the police department?
Okay. I have been very involved against the officers of GTTF. Starting in 2010 was when I first realized Sergeant Wayne Jenkins was not an ethical officer. I had a number of cases with him. We filed numerous motions, and it's sad because both of the opponents knew that these officers were bad. They've used these officers in the past. And it wasn't until the federal government did their own indictment. I represented a number of people. I represented a number of people that were testifying against the officers. I represented a number of people that have sued these officers as well. So when I sit down and look at what's been going on, you can easily stop that. The state's attorney's office had the information. They had lying prosecutors who were telling the upper administration these officers were not believable. Excuse me. But you have to have a system of checks and balances. I propose a program called Public Corruption Division. My Public Corruption Division will sit down. They will monitor what's going on, and they will sit down and investigate the complaints. I'm the only person in this race that believes in a do-not-call list, where officers are not called once we have those types of complaints. And so once you're able to sit down and investigate them, you have an officer who's not truthful in court, we have to immediately investigate that. We can't call that officer. Otherwise, you'll call the officer and dismiss 150 cases. Now, in reference to the relationship with the police department, I also sued the police. Remember the young man on Greenmount who was beaten up by the police officer, that videotape? I was the individual that sued the police then. So this isn't about the entire police department. This is about going after the officers who do not want to wear that badge the appropriate way and don't want to do things the appropriate way. One of the things that we're not doing properly, we're not using or looking at body camera footage. The body camera footage will sit down and let you know what's going on. The body camera footage I will use as a training mechanism to show officers good arrest and bad arrest.
So what evidence do you have that the body cameras, which have now been in effect for, you know, been in place for some time, are not being used
appropriately by the state's attorney's office? Perfect example. You saw the state's attorney's office charge some officers, I guess about 2 months ago, in terms of allegedly planting drugs. Well, it was the public defender's office that was given the body camera footage by the state's attorney's office that saw this, that had to tell the state's attorney's office what was on the video. Once again, you have young prosecutors who don't understand what's going on, and they don't even understand that we could have caught that issue way before the public defender's office did. So if you have prosecutors who know what's going on, I propose hiring a number of retired officers who they can sit down, and they know good Fourth Amendment cases. We can sit down and see the violations. We can headed off before we ever have a person sitting in jail for 9 months. But if you don't have that division appropriately staffed and appropriately funded, then you're always going to make mistakes. Body camera footage is really changing the way in which you now prosecute cases.
Victoria writes in on Facebook, what does Mr. Bates propose to do about juvenile crime in Baltimore? Unfortunately, juvenile crime, very front of mind this week. We have a young man from Baltimore on the east side and three friends of his now charged with first-degree murder.
Yes.
And the death of Officer Amy Caprio up in Baltimore County. These four young kids are being tried as adults.
Yes.
Is that a good idea? There is obviously a breakdown somewhere in the juvenile justice system. We have Ms. Mosby accusing the Secretary of Juvenile Justice at the state level, and we have the Secretary accusing Ms. Mosby. There's a lot of accusations going back and forth, but what's your philosophy about how juvenile justice should be handled?
Okay. Well, the first thing we have to do, elected officials have to stop pointing the finger at everybody else. Elected officials have to eventually admit that there was a breakdown in their office, because there was one. I was in juvenile. I think I was the only person involved in this race that's ever been in a juvenile system. It's a convoluted system, but it's one you have to understand. I'm the only one proposing off the start to change and reform the juvenile system in the state's attorney's office. Right now, prosecutors are young, and juvenile system in the state's attorney's office is used as a training ground. So a lot of prosecutors don't even understand the job. I want to have prosecutors who are dedicated 100% to the juvenile system, which means when a young child comes in the system, that we know who they are. We have to give real extensive wraparound services to the kids at 10, 11, 12. With the extensive wraparound services and the programs, such as a program such as THREAD that we should partner with. Or you sit down and look at, they were spending millions of dollars in a ROCA system.
Now, when we say we, do you mean the state's attorney's office?
The city, through the GBC, they're funding programs such as ROCA. You have other community.
So not as a function of the state's
attorney's office, but partnering with the groups that are already there. There are so many groups that are on the ground right now doing the work. We need to provide as many wraparound services as possible. Now, this I personally feel was an avoidable situation. This young man, he's crying out for help because of his actions. When he decides to leave a facility, allegedly steal a car, and this is all allegedly, he's letting you know that, hey, I need extensive wraparound services. The type of wraparound services that being on electronic monitoring isn't going to get, because they've already shown that he's a flight risk. Because when I sit down and look at this, I see a system that's failed this young man, but I see a system that also failed that poor officer in the community. There has to be a balance where you treat the children as children, but it's the extensive wraparound services, giving them the counseling that they need. We ask the question, why did they do this, instead of what got them to this point? When we understand what got them to the point that they're at, then we can understand the wraparound services. Maybe his mother's not around. Maybe he has other anger management issues. Maybe there are issues that he had growing up that he's never talked to anybody about. Once we're able to get that young man or that young lady those services and those programs in the juvenile system, then we can hopefully avoid the adult system. But we have to give extensive wraparound services at an earlier age and hold the young kids accountable.
Can you explain a thing to me as well? Baltimore Sun reported that one of the dimensions of this case that I found just horrifying and disconcerting, to say the least. This young man, Duante Harris, who has confessed to the Baltimore County Police that he drove the car that killed Officer Caprio, was on home detention. Now, whether or not he should have been on home detention is a whole other universe, but he has this bracelet. This bracelet that monitors whether or not he's in his home where he's supposed to be. The Sun reports that that bracelet has no GPS, so that once he leaves his home, law enforcement officials know that he's left, but they don't know where he is. Jane Miller from Channel 11 reported that an officer saw Mr. Harris on the street a couple of days before this incident, but didn't realize, because he hadn't been informed by juvenile services or anybody else, that Harris was on home detention and shouldn't have been on the street. Is the technology and the avenues of communication, are they that behind the times? Are they that screwed up?
Well, and that's why I say you have to make the change from the state's attorney's office, because people aren't cooperating and they're not working together. So what I propose is simple. Anytime that young child has a movement, every day we'll have some sort of report, an email report from DJJ. Those wraparound services must be so intensive. That's why you need to have prosecutors dedicated to the children, because they know their caseload. They know who their children are. They know, you know what, he's supposed to be at home. He's cut off his bracelet. Automatically, they give information to the police department to say, in this district, look out for this young man.
There's a lot of kids in the city who are in the position that Duanta Harris appears to have been in. Can the state's attorney's office does the office have the scale to monitor in this kind of close, very intense way, all of those children?
State's attorney's office has a number of programs that look at high risk juveniles. Some of those programs are grants. We'll have to go out and get those grants, but yes, they do. They have, I think one time they had 24, 25 prosecutors. When you sit down and look at the caseload for these 24, 25 prosecutors with technology, it's easy because you're having school counselors reach out, you're having DJS reach out, you'll have the prosecutor. It's a wraparound service. We're not doing it by ourselves, but we're doing it with a team. That's not happening, and we have to do that.
Let's go to the phones, please. We have a call from Herbert in Baltimore City. Herbert, welcome to Midday with Mr. Bates.
Hello. Thanks, Tom. Look, I wanted to ask you because Ms. Mosby has been saying that Mr. Bates is the FOP's lawyer, and I wanted to get in to hear his thoughts on whether or not that's true or not.
All right. Thanks for the call. FOP, of course, is the Fraternal Order of Police. That's the union for the police department.
Okay. Thank you, Herbert. That's funny. Absolutely not. When we sit down and look at it, there's only actually one person in this race that's ever accepted a campaign contribution from the FOP, and that's been Ms. Mosby. So when I sit down and look at that, it could not be further from the truth. Remember, I'm the one who actually sued the police in that regard. So it's disheartening that you have those types of rumors. But this campaign season, so I guess that's what's happening.
We have an email from Joanne in Baltimore who says, I can't help thinking that the failure to filter out bad arrests quickly is intentional. Some police act as judge and jury, able to punish anyone they want by throwing them in jail for weeks until they get set free. You don't have to be guilty to be punished, just arrested and poor. There are a lot of people, Mr. Bates, who have no trust whatsoever in the police department. The department is under a consent decree by the Department of Justice, Federal Department of Justice. The turmoil at the top of the police department continues, with the last police commissioner lasting a period of weeks before he resigned. There's a national search for somebody else. Lord knows how long that will take. The trust between the state's attorney's office and the department is important, as well as the trust between the community and the police department is important. How do you build and improve the trust between people who live here and the police who are sworn to protect?
When I look at this race, I think what totally makes me unique out of anybody in the race is that I've been on both sides. You have prosecutors, and I was a prosecutor for 6 years. You have defense attorneys. I've been a defense attorney the rest of my career. So I see the system from both angles. I have seen the criminal justice system through the eyes of victims. That's all prosecutors really see, the eyes of victims. They don't see what charging an innocent person does. They don't understand what it means to be a person who works two jobs, to be charged on just the word of a juvenile when you didn't do anything, you weren't there, but to lose everything that you've worked so hard for when you finally have a job, when you finally purchase that house. I've stood next to that person. So to me, I recognize when the most important jobs that we can have is making sure that we protect people's rights. When I sit down and look at a blueprint, I look at no further than someone like in Philadelphia, Mr. Krasner. When you look at him to see what he's doing in real criminal justice reform, we can't just talk about it. We have to do it. And when you sit down and look at the reform that he's doing, you have to build a bridge. And as a former prosecutor, I understand the law. I'm going to be fair. As a defense attorney, I understand what it's like to have and be confused about the law. So not only do I have my word, but I'm also going to sit down and show you all the things that I have done.
So is the current administration prosecuting the wrong people, or are they prosecuting the people that they are bringing to trial incompetently?
Both. Sometimes the police are just wrong, and sometimes they are in a rush and they can't.
So their discernment is a problem in your eyes. I mean, in other words, they're taking bad cases.
They're taking bad cases and they don't know the difference between a good case and a bad case. When you sit down and look at the numbers of null process, you shouldn't have that many null process, especially at the circuit court level, because you're wasting time, you're wasting energy, you're wasting money. But more importantly, you've now given a person who should not be under the criminal justice system a charge that's hanging over their head. They may not be able to get a job. They may be unemployed. Then because they cannot work, now they may have to go back into the world or go into the world or do something illegal.
Yeah, but I'm not a lawyer, forgive me, but isn't the fact that they're choosing to dismiss cases an indication that they're taking a look and they're saying, well, the case isn't strong enough. We don't have the evidence. We don't have the testimony that we would need to successfully prosecute the case.
That's something they should have known from the first 30 days. You don't wait and indict the case. Once the state's attorney's office indicts the case, the state's attorney is saying, we believe in this case and we can prove this case beyond a reasonable doubt. Too many of those cases are happening and being dismissed or null-prossed in the circuit court level. For instance, there was a gun case recently against a repeat violent offender. The state's attorney had never reached out to the police to find out that their officers were on vacation. So when they needed to have the handgun brought and that evidence brought to court, there was no officer. Why? Because they had never communicated with the police officer to realize the officer who submitted the gun was on vacation. The officer did what they were supposed to. The state's attorney didn't.
Got to take a break. Former city prosecutor Ivan Bates is my guest. He's one of three Democrats running in the June 26th primary to be Baltimore City State's Attorney. We'll continue our conversation after a quick break. When we come back, we'll try to sneak in some more of your calls, questions, and comments. 410-662-8780. That's our number. Our email, midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet at @MiddayWYPR, and you can find us on Facebook on the WYPR Facebook page. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.
Welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us, my guest is Ivan Bates, the first of three candidates who will join me in the next couple of weeks who are running in the Democratic primary for Baltimore City State's Attorney. This is part of our series of conversations with the candidates. His rivals are former Maryland Deputy Attorney General Thiru Vignaraja and the incumbent Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby. If you have questions or comments for Mr. Bates, our phone number 410-662-8780, our email midday@wypr.org. You can send us a tweet @MiddayWYPR. You can find us on the WYPR Facebook page. Let's go back to the phones. Clarence in New Freedom, Pennsylvania. Welcome to Midday with Ivan Bates.
Thank you, Tom, for taking my call. I'll take my answer off the air, but my question to Mr. Bates is, it's a known fact in Baltimore City that you have lawyers that are defending not only juveniles, but adults, and they're going through the court system, and you want to blame the state's attorney's office. You can't do that if you have lawyers that aren't doing what they're supposed to do. If you have a juvenile, he's going through the court system four, five, six times, and these lawyers are still defending these people, why is it that they're not getting convicted and being locked up? I'll take my comment off the air. Thank you.
All right. Thanks for the call, Clarence.
So thank you for calling, Clarence. So within the criminal justice system, everybody, the Constitution says everybody's entitled to an attorney, to a defense. So the lawyers are just doing their job. Now, the state's attorney, they're the one who brings the case. The state's attorney is the one who's responsible for achieving a conviction. The state's attorney is the one who's responsible for holding an individual accountable. It is the state's attorney's office that brings the evidence. The state's attorney's office that is running the entire show. So that is why the state's attorney is responsible, because it's their job. Defense attorneys are only going to do and provide a level of defense. For instance, when you sit down and you look at what's happening in Baltimore County, they don't have these problems or issue because the prosecutors out there, they're going to hold people accountable. They're going to make sure they get a conviction. On the federal side, they're going to hold people accountable in terms of the U.S. Attorney's Office. Every other jurisdiction around the state is able to hold individuals accountable. But unfortunately, right now in Baltimore City, they cannot get the job done. They don't have the experience and they just aren't good at what they're doing.
When it comes to juveniles, you talked about the need for wraparound services. That's one side of it. But when it comes to a specific case, and again, you're not involved in this case of Duante Harris and the death of Officer Caprio up in Baltimore County, but should juveniles like him, who's he's a 16-year-old teenager, should they be charged as juveniles or as adults?
Well, the law states, based on the offense that he's charged with, that he has to be charged as an adult. And so what happened is they will have a report that will list five factors as to why he should possibly be tried as a juvenile. So the law already takes that into consideration. Now, there are some actions that are so heinous that juveniles will have to be tried as adults because you have to hold them accountable. That's why it's so important to get the wraparound service at such an early, early age. All the research, and I've learned a great deal from my wife, who is a school psychologist and who studied this for years, and all the research shows us the earlier we can give wraparound services at 11 and 12, the better outcome we have. Once an individual who's 16, 17 has been arrested and through the system five, six, seven times, we've pretty much lost our opportunity.
But a lot of folks would say, okay, he's 16, 17 years old. That's old enough to know the difference between right and wrong. There are a whole lot of folks out there who are listening and saying, you know, at some point you just got to give up on the kids, right? So they are willing and more than willing to give up on this young man, throw him in jail for the rest of his life, and that's that. What's your response to the voter who thinks that?
Well, you can't give up on anybody. I mean, when I sit down and look, there's going to be something positive about everybody. Well, we can't give up on the kids. Now, maybe this young man has to sit down, do a period of incarceration for his actions, but that young man can still learn. That young man still can do something positive within their life. I think there are so many stories of individuals that have gone into the prison system, turned their life around. But what I'm realizing more and more, to stop the slowdown in terms of the growth of the gangs, we have to really get our hand on the criminal justice system, the juvenile side. The gangs and the juvenile systems become a feeding ground for many of the gangs. So until we provide the wraparound services as an entire group, then we're going to be destined to see this type of behavior continue.
When we talk about repeat offenders, everybody mentions them, both people running for governor, I've talked to them, people when they were running for mayor talked about this, people in Baltimore County executive race talked about repeat offenders. How do you target repeat offenders and at the same time reduce incarceration? Because so many people also acknowledge that in the United States, as a general rule, we are over-incarcerated, although we should acknowledge that incarceration rates actually have come down in the last several years.
Well, especially in Maryland. Maryland, I think, almost leads the country in terms of incarcerations going down in the past few years. And that's Restorative Justice Act. I think with repeat violent offenders, from day one, I'm going to sit down with the 10 top prosecutors that are left in that office. We've lost so many in that office. The 10 top prosecutors, we're going to sit down and go through the case of every single repeat violent offender. And we're going to make sure we go after the top 100. And those are the individuals that we're going to make sure we hold responsible. Once you're holding violent offenders responsible, repeat violent offenders, the message will clearly get out that this is what we're going to do and hold you responsible. Those 10 top prosecutors, they will be part of a unit that makes sure that the repeat violent offenders do not fall through the crack. So whether it's a murder, an attempt murder, a carjacking, a rape, or a big drug distribution ring, we will make sure that repeat violent offenders, they will have a prosecutor who will be assigned, who will have experience to hold them accountable.
All of the people who are both committing the murders that we've seen in the last few years here in Baltimore and are victims of the murders, the average interactions they've had, the average number of arrests they've had are anywhere between 9 and 11 per person.
Yes.
These are people who are being killed and committing murders who have been arrested and incarcerated in many cases before. This retaliation appears to be a big animating factor. People are settling their grievances outside of the court system, outside of the police system. They're just simply going after the people who they feel have wronged them. The capacity of the state's attorney to do anything about that.
Well, I want to propose a program called Community Prosecution, where we sit down, we meet the community where they are. It's not until you build relationships with my prosecutors will be in the community, the police, and the citizens. Once they're able to do that, we know one another. We're able to reach out with one another. For instance, state's attorney's office uses their community liaisons to go into community meetings to show that they're say they're doing a great job. Once a murder happens, my community liaison will immediately reach out to that victim's family before an arrest has ever been made, because we have to build that relationship. And building that relationship allows us to maybe get the information to be that bridge between that family and the police, because they don't trust the police. Once we're able to do that, we're able to work together as a community and have the state's attorney's office take the lead, especially for programs such as community prosecution. It worked in New York City and drove down the numbers. I know it can work here. I understand the program, and that'll be the program that I will lead.
George in West Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Ivan Bates.
Hey, guy. How you doing?
Good.
Mr. Bates.
Yes, sir.
Quick question. I don't know how old you are, but if I were to say the name Detective Frank Cervico, would that mean anything to you?
They made a movie about him. He's a New York cop. Get to your point, George. I appreciate the line of questioning, but we need to get to the point because we're running out of time.
All right. Well, the question is, Frank Cervico was instrumental in cleaning up the corruption in New York City. He stated emphatically, until you address the corruption in your police department, you will never get rid of the crime in your city. Here in Baltimore City, I'm a registered voter. I've been out just on the street for over 30 years. The Baltimore City Police Department seems to have this attitude that they are a member of an elite group, come out to the community and just do things to antagonize individual citizens and communities across the street.
Okay, George, thank you so much. I think we get your drift here. Again, restoring confidence or even creating confidence. I mean, you can't restore where nothing exists to begin with, between the community and the police.
I've sued the police, so I understand. Being a criminal defense attorney, I've seen more of those officers that I feel. There are still a few that have no business being on the force, but you have to be understanding.
Do you envision any sort of special unit or special thing to deal with police corruption?
My public corruption division will be a specialized unit, and that's what they'll do, and they'll focus on it. What people don't realize to
process. Is that not in place now?
Not the way that I will do it, where they will specifically be focused and investigate. But one of the things that the state's attorney's office doesn't do, we will make sure we employ a use of force expert every single day. A use of force expert will make sure that the police will be held accountable to make sure the prosecutions can stack up to win. Without a use of force expert, the state's attorney's office is just shooting in the dark. And it's that experience that allows me to understand we need that.
Just got a minute or so left. What about judges? Governor Hogan has criticized judges. Various police commissioners have criticized judges. The current state's attorney and the one before her criticized judges. What is your take on what can be done, what should be done, and whether or not the judges are acting in ways that you think are constitutionally correct?
Well, what a lot of people don't understand is in 2015, the law changed a case called Sharp. And it took the power from judges in terms of sentencing and gave it to the state's attorney's office. So now a judge can recommend a sentence, but the state's attorney's office can say, no, we don't agree with that. So we can no longer really point the fingers at judges. Judges can sentence now if a person's found guilty in trial. But remember, judges also live here in the community. Now, there are some judges that we would like to see them a little tougher. But right now, in the past 3 years, one of the main reasons we've seen an explosion in crime is because now that is totally in the hands of the state's attorney's office.
Ivan Bates, it's been a pleasure meeting you, and I'm glad we had a chance to have a conversation. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
Ivan Bates is a trial attorney and former city prosecutor. He's one of three candidates running in the primary for Democratic nomination to be Baltimore City State's attorney. As part of our continuing series of conversations with the candidates, I'll be speaking with Mr. Bates' rivals in the race for state's attorney, former federal and city prosecutor, former Maryland Deputy Attorney General Thiru Vignaraja. He'll be my guest a week from tomorrow, and the incumbent Baltimore City State's Attorney Marilyn Mosby will join me for the hour on Monday, June 11th. So we hope that you'll join us for those conversations. All of my interviews with candidates for governor, for Baltimore County Executive, and other local races are easy to find on your phone, your tablet, or your computer. Come to WIPR.org/midday and subscribe to our podcast. That's it for us today. We want to thank Eddie's of Roland Park for providing lunch. Eddie's is a full-service market with locations on North Charles Street and on Roland Avenue in Roland Park. Their deli features a variety of sandwiches and salads, all listed on their website, eddiesofrolandpark.com. Coming up tomorrow, Derek Thompson is the author of a best-selling book called Hitmakers. It is really quite a fascinating read. He examines the science of popularity. So why do some things and some people become popular and others don't? So that'll be fun. That's coming up tomorrow on Midday. Derek Thompson joins me here on our program. Here and Now is up next after a break for news at the top of the hour. I'm Tom Hall. Appreciate your listening. Have a great day.
You're listening to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.